You're storing memories to lose them again. You'll forget everything when this whole thing ends. You can't even predict what tomorrow brings. But don't lose track of living in the present.
Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Verneri.
And I'm John Deck, and each week we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And this week...
So it seems you've discovered your unpleasant nature.
How are you?
We might ask the same question.
That's right, we're watching Dark City from 1998, directed by Alex Proyas. John, we were talking, after we recorded last week's episode, about... what to do, and we figured, you know, we talked about The Matrix and how, you know, certain movies get compared to other movies like John Wick and things like that. So we said, oh, what if we do, like you suggested, what if we do a movie that that is like The Matrix, or we do some movies that people say are like The Matrix, and this happened to be one of the ones that we thought of. I don't remember a ton about it, though, so I'm not 100% sure if it is like The Matrix or not. What do you remember about this, John?
Not a lot.
How long has it been since you watched it?
Oh, a very long time. Maybe 15 plus years for sure.
It might be even longer for me. I think it was like 99 or 2000 the last time I watched this.
Yeah, actually, now that I think about it, that might be true. It's been a long time. Yeah. I don't remember a great deal about it, except I think it's got Kiefer Sutherland in it.
IMDb seems to confirm that.
And that, like, that idea with the Matrix of people being, like, within a world within a world, and, like, you know, like, I think this was more like a dark, like, noir style kind of sci-fi, and it, like, had elements of, like, someone trying to figure out if they're in the right world or not, or if they're remembering things that did or didn't happen, or, like, I get it. Yeah, that's about it. Like, I get into
all of that seems to track for me.
I get, like, this feel of the movie more than, and, like, I personally don't go, oh yeah, like, this is just like The Matrix. But so many people through ancillary comments have said, oh well, you know, if you've never heard of this movie, it's because a little movie called The Matrix came out like half a year later and blew everything out of the water and stole the limelight from this movie. And so I really don't know if we'll see a lot of similarities between the two. I remember having a good opinion of the movie, but then again, especially back, you know, 20 plus years ago, I just watched a ton of sci-fi movies and enjoyed a lot of them. So I don't know if I can trust that part of me, especially as you and I have done many times where we dig up a movie to watch and then it just ends up being like, what? This is garbage. But this might be amazing. I really just don't know.
I remember really liking it. I remember this being the first Rufus Sewell movie that I saw and thinking, wow, this guy's going places, and then didn't see him in much else until The Man in the High Castle came out. Like, he's sort of flown under the radar, and it makes me sad because I think he's a really, really talented actor. I do remember liking this. It does have Kiefer Sutherland. It does have Jennifer Connelly. It has William Hurt, and these are all actors who I enjoy watching, and so I have a feeling I'm gonna probably like this. I think it's probably gonna have some flaws to it. I'm almost certain that it's gonna be a little on the lower budget side, and that's probably gonna be one of my complaints about it. But I could also be completely wrong, and this is a visual masterpiece that just got panned for no reason. So we're going to find out. We're going to go and watch this. It is currently streaming for free on Canopy. That's Canopy with a K. Or you can get it from the streaming rental providers, or if you have it in your personal collection, get it there. Anyway, when we come back, we are talking Dark City. John, are you ready?
I'm dark ready. That's my new thing.
Then let's do it.
Dark, do it.
Welcome back, John. I guess we should stay up top real quick. John and I watched different versions of this film. I believe I watched the theatrical cut, and John, you watched the director's cut, correct?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so we'll talk about some of those differences. But John, initial thoughts out of the gate, anything you want to impart on the listener? Did you enjoy this movie? Is it good?
You know what? The answer is it's good. There you go.
All right. That's our show, everyone. Thanks. I agree. In some senses, I do have some issues with the movie, which we'll talk about.
Issues?
But on the whole, I enjoyed it. So,
I think it was. I appreciated several things about it. Everything from I feel like some of these things are ironically, but there's certain parallels to some of the things that we enjoyed about watching The Crow, which is directed by the same guy. So,
correct.
It doesn't surprise me that he nailed atmosphere and the cityscape and feelings of, you know, darkness and shadows as characters within it almost. And like all of these things are, you know, he has done and done well again. And in this particular movie, the definitive nod to the noir aesthetic and the fact that, of course, it's Dark City. And you discover why later. It's not just because it's moody and atmospheric, but because that's what the aliens got to do so they don't blow up in the sunlight, you know? So it's like there are things that grated on me a little bit that I didn't like too much, that I thought felt a little bit too fake and too, like, nondescript and stuff. And then as you get back into the movie again and the reveals of what's happening goes on, it's like, oh, yeah, of course it's going to feel that way. That's actually good. This is good that that feels that way. So yeah, there were moments that I questioned what was going on, and sometimes they circled back by the time the viewing was done, and things were pretty comprehensively brought back together, at least as far as any bits of mystery that were revealed. Some things were just never told to us.
Right, and I think that probably lends itself to why this movie only just broke even. There's a lot going on here. So first of all, this movie's all over the fucking place. Like, it doesn't know if it's trying to be a noir movie all the time. Sometimes it thinks it's trying to be a thriller or a sci-fi movie or an action film. And it's jarring if that's not something that you're expecting. And do not get me wrong. This movie sets out to accomplish a goal, and it does it in spades. And it crushes that goal. The thing is that the average viewer, I think, isn't ready for that type of storytelling. And so you get a lot of, what the hell is this? And not a whole lot of positive reception there. So it's something that you have to either be ready for or be someone who's in the frame of mind to go, yes, I'd love to watch a movie like that. Because it's a very specific type of movie that is nondescript.
Well, I think it requires the ability to, like you're saying, to take in what you're seeing, whether or not it 100% makes sense or feels a little bit like it's all over the place or kind of jilted and sharp edges here and there. But I feel like the reality of the movie itself is that it's more about the psychological take on what is memory and what is identity and what makes people unique. And so the fact that it sometimes feels like a sci-fi movie. Sometimes it feels like a detective noir mystery. Sometimes it feels like a some kind of romance or drama or period piece. Sometimes it, like, it just kind of, I think the fact that it moves around a lot can easily tie back into the idea that the strangers, the alien telepathic powered people or whatever you want to,
the Morlocks, like,
yeah, like, I think like their experiments, what they were trying to achieve, what was going on, and the very nature of this place ties back into why everything kind of felt wrong and out of place at times. It was supposed to feel kind of fake and false and not quite real, because that was the reality that was constructed. So in a way it's kind of a cop-out, but in a way it's like, that's just the nature of this experiment that we were made to witness.
I think that there's really something to that. And before you find out that this is an experiment that's happening, and like, before you get sort of most of that picture, there are a lot of unanswered questions that are kind of lingering there. And one thing that this movie, I feel, did really well was make sure that, like, it didn't ask a question and then just let it sort of float away. Like, you kept asking the question. Even if you didn't get an answer, you were still thinking about that thing 20 minutes later when you're on to something else.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the presentation of the movie, the main thing that's different in the director's cut compared to the theatrical release, like, there's a bunch of small things that, like, small changes. Certain scenes are extended by 10 seconds here, 10 seconds there. So, like, a lot of minor things, but there's only, like, one big major change, and then one change that's not major, but it's aesthetic and goes throughout the whole movie. The color grading on the director's cut is a little more gray. It takes out even more of the color, so it's less saturated.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you have it just kind of lends it more to that you're watching things in shadows more, and it's dark, and there's just not very much color dynamic to it. But the big major change is in the beginning, there's no voiceover. There's no big long, and I didn't watch the version, but when I was reading about the differences, I was vaguely recalled that, and they're like, yeah, there's no big long voiceover description in the beginning telling you anything.
Oh, that's wild.
And there's no scene in the beginning where everybody just freezes, you know, at midnight or whatever.
Oh, really?
So you jump into a scene with Kiefer Sutherland as the doctor, it's like when he's going to call John Murdoch to tell him, you know, you gotta run because people are coming for me. Like, that's where the movie starts, essentially.
Oh, wow, that's pretty that's a pretty big difference there.
Yeah, and it really makes it even more like, what the hell is going on? Like, you're not served up something and then kind of go back into the story and try to find out where you are. It's like, from the very beginning, you're just like building little pieces one after another, trying to figure out what's happening.
Yeah, because man, I can't imagine that, because I was already on my heels, 20, 30 minutes into this movie. So having that in addition is like even more jarring. You know what I was actually kind of surprised to find out about this movie? Was that it's all original.
Yeah.
There's not source material for it. Like, I thought maybe this, especially given the aesthetic that we got with it, I thought maybe it was based on a comic book, like a noir comic book or something. And no, it was just like really inspired by that kind of filmmaking that happened back, you know, in the 40s and 50s.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and the screenplay was written by David Goyer.
Right, too.
since then has written a bunch of stuff, like The Dark Knight, and, right, you know, he wrote the Blade trilogy, I think, maybe. But he wrote a lot of these things, and you can see he comes back to the well. And, like, on the one hand, you know, people might go, oh, wow, so this really inspired other things. And it's like, well, yeah, but also the guy who wrote this wrote some of those things that you think inspire it. But you do see, even when there's directors like Christopher Nolan, who obviously did The Dark Knight and all that stuff, but like David Goyer didn't write Inception, but Inception is clearly colored by Dark City, you know? And so it's interesting parallels to the point where, you know, you have an Inception, you know, they're entering people's dreams and they have architects who are like shifting and changing the landscapes in order to like alter things and tell different stories. And you don't know if it was a dream or not. Like, and like, there's just so many parallels there. That is just fascinating to see when you have those overlaps and you're wondering like, which thing impacted what, like where did the inspiration really come from? And is there anything that's new or is everything just a retelling of something else?
Well, so that issue echoes way, way out beyond this though, right? Like one of the chief complaints that I always hear and that I tend to have myself lately is that there's nothing original coming out of Hollywood anymore. Like there's not really original stories that are being produced and they're just trying to squeeze every drop they can out of these sort of generic stories. And so you get things that are either adapted from or borrowing from or have elements of all this past material. How many times are we going to, you know, reboot Batman? How many times are we going to reboot the Justice League or how many times are we going to reboot Fantastic Four? You know, how many times are we going to just keep rehashing the same shit over and over again?
As long as it keeps making money,
I guess. Yeah,
I mean, there's absolutely refreshingly creative, interesting things happening all the time that don't get a lot of publicity. But there's things I forgot, like for example, a movie I forgot to mention on our previous year roundup show was something that I thought you'd appreciate, even though I'm not saying it's perfect and great and tangible and makes sense, but I'm saying it's, if you want originality, go on, I think I want to say Amazon or Hulu, probably Amazon, and watch Annette. Have you heard of this movie?
I want to say I have. Hold on. It's a movie, right?
It's a movie.
Musical psychological drama film directed by Lewis Carax. This is English language debut. Adam Driver. Okay. Yeah. Simon Helberg. So what is this movie about?
I'm not going to tell you that, and I'm not going to tell our listeners that. But you should put it on your slate of things to experience. If nothing else, if you're a fan of Adam Driver, you know, he's awesome in it. But it's like a fascinating story told in a weird way. And if nothing else, you'll walk away from it saying, you know what? I've never seen anything like this before. And so, but no, it's artistic. It's really weird. It's interesting. It has different vibes to it throughout. But it's just that this whole idea of Dark City and all the things you said about ideas being done and then redone or things being borrowed or all that kind of stuff, that there's every once in a while movies come out, like I think of Parasite when that came out a couple of years ago.
Right.
And like there's things you come out and you're just like, that was just amazing. And that didn't feel like every other thing I've seen. And so you kind of have both things happening. And I admit sometimes it's comforting to see a Fast and the Furious movie that gives you everything you want. Sometimes it fails like it did, you know, last year. But, but you know, sometimes those predictable things, like a lot of Marvel movies, like a lot of the big blockbuster things, that there's a certain level of, I've kind of been there and done that. And I'm kind of just want more of it because it's just, you know, delicious junk food and I want to chomp down on it. But really with Dark City, I mean, I know that there were all these like sci-fi movies that came out within a year or two, you know, in this realm that all kind of have the different, like everybody knows the Matrix, like I think we probably mentioned in the opening before we watched this.
We did, yeah.
And that came out, I think, less than a year after this. And that, of course, took over so many things culturally and well-deserved, you know, like, but it overshadowed a lot of other movies that may have gotten some traction because they just got all pushed away because everyone wanted to exalt the Matrix, and that's fine. But then there were at least three or four other movies around that time that had similar sci-fi future noir type feels to them, like Existence with a Z was one. There were just a number that were trying to toe that line between, you know, cyberpunk and like retro and something, you know, very dark and mysterious but also futuristic, and like it's a tough thing to grasp. And that's why, like, I think in this movie some of the things it does really well are like come from that point of view of the aesthetics, and they build things into it later, like the appearance of the strangers, you know, the physical, everything from their wardrobe, from these long black overcoats with the duster hats or whatever they were wearing, like the fedora types.
Wild. It's like spy versus spy.
Yeah, but then they're all like white skinned and bald and super skinny, and then you have the one real tall guy, medium sized guy, and the little kid, and mm-hmm. they just kind of almost float around when they're walking sometimes, and it's like that's a good creepy aesthetic to make this feel otherworldly right there, you know, like in an instant you feel like there's something more going on here. These could be like old school Bela Lugosi type Dracula figures. Mm-hmm. It's like, you don't know, like, what are we dealing with here? And so those things, I think, really also built well into this, along with all the design and architecture and all that.
You know, when the strangers first revealed themselves, or when we first saw them, the first thing that popped into my head was Nosferatu. So, like, the whole Bela Lugosi and Dracula is not too far off of where I was anyway.
Well, why don't you tell me about, like, some of the things that you had problems with outside of the general stuff that you've mentioned?
I mean, that was mainly it. Like, it was the fact that it was all over the place. I think that I didn't get an identity from this movie until it was almost done. And that kind of grated on me a little bit, just because, like, I want to know what I'm holding out for. And I get that that's sort of what this movie is going for. Like, it's trying to not necessarily define itself and keep you on the edge of your seat and guessing until the very end. But I don't know. It just, for some reason, I didn't get a good feel of the movie. And so I had trouble absorbing it.
I feel like for me, it was, I spent like, I don't know, maybe a solid half hour after watching it just thinking about it, which doesn't happen a lot with movies with me, especially ones that I'm rewatching. But I was just trying to piece it all together and to really understand, because they don't spell it out. And I appreciate that, actually. I think they give you a lot, but they don't really tell you much. Some things, even with as much thought as I could put into it, still don't quite make sense, but I give it some allowances because it's, you know, within that sci-fi genre of things that you don't always know what's happening. It's almost like magic where you have to just accept certain rules and physics and things like that. Okay, that's fine. Like, why is it, in their vast experiments of trying to understand the human psyche, why is it that when they reset the clock, like, why do they have to, like, totally redo all of the buildings and stretch them out and shrink them down and give them three extra floors? Like, does that change everything, like, in the human psyche? Like, what, like, giving someone new memories and seeing how that works, that's one thing, but like, to be like, no, we gotta put on a fire escape now, that's now we'll see real results. So it's like, some of it felt like it was more about style than substance. And okay, you know what, that happens. But like, that idea of taking someone from being poor to being well off, and then trying to see, okay, it's the same person, but now they've always known and thought and felt that they're rich and well off. How does that influence the decisions they make in a day-to-day scenario? Like, that's interesting to me that for some reason is something that they wanted to understand, and that we never are told why their species is dying exactly. Like, they're dying, and somehow when they've left their world or whatever, looking for answers to not die, they came across Earth, and then they abducted these people, and they grabbed a bunch of corpses so they could make bodies for their little jellyfish head things. but like, so they abducted these people, and they thought, you know, they were this hive mind species that is like trying to become more individualistic because they think that might be the answer. So is it like some sort of weird inbreeding thing that's causing them to just die out as a species? I just, you know, who knows? But that process of testing memories, it's a nice spin on that nature versus nurture thing. And I thought the central mystery of the serial killer prostitute thing, I thought that was really interesting because it's like, what if you were given the memories that you had killed people, would you just continue killing people because you accept that's who you are because that's what you've done in the past? You know, it's like, how much do the memories of things you've done influence your future behavior? And like, it's an interesting thought experiment. I don't know, you know, like, I don't know what that is, because that, as far as I know, I haven't been just randomly implanted with memories, but maybe I have.
Yeah, but you would have no way of knowing.
I would have no way of knowing
if my memories were replaced of who John was. And, you know, we could go on and on about that and have a huge existential crisis.
Maybe, but we already have.
And we probably have, knowing us. But what I wanted to say was that's what I wanted more of. And I think that that's why I felt so dissatisfied with this, was because I got all of these really interesting concepts of characters and scenarios and murder and serial killing and all this other stuff. And then you go ahead and you just fucking pivot 90 degrees and go in this completely other direction. And then you pivot again and go in another direction. And it's like, fuck, like, let me have something to hold on to besides just John fucking Murdoch.
Yeah, you know what? I think a wasted opportunity in that part of the storytelling is with Kiefer Sutherland's character.
Absolutely.
If he could have been that voice, that's what he was selected for. You know, he was selected to be the human representative to help make sense of things, because these aliens didn't really understand people and their emotions and their memories and all that. So if he would have, instead of just, I mean, don't get me wrong, I liked his performance. It was very embodying a character and doing what he could with it. A lot of interesting choices there, making him very fragile. He was like out of breath every time he did anything, and like, that's okay, cool, like, that's fine. But if you would have given him maybe 7 or 8 more minutes of dialogue here and there throughout the movie where he's explaining to John or to anyone, saying, you know, like, this is why they did it. They wanted to know what would happen, and this is the reason. Like, if they would have tied it together with just a little more exposition, a little more putting it on rails so you understood where this part came from and where it's going next. Because by the time you get to the end, it really, you are a little bit exhausted with the whole process, and it's like, you kind of, there's a little bit of a joy that comes from trying to piece things together, but at the same time, you can get burned out and just decide it's not worth it. So it's a delicate balancing act.
It is. And again, I think that's probably one area where this movie suffered. Like, it's just, it didn't walk a fine enough line to hold an audience, I think.
Yeah.
But there was something that I wanted to bring up before. You had mentioned, you know, The Matrix coming out almost a year after this. One of the things that I think that could have helped this movie along a little bit more, it was a better effects budget. Like, their total budget was $27 million, which, granted, is not huge, but it's still pretty good in 1998 dollars. But it's only about a third of the budget that The Matrix had. And they filmed in the same studio, and they filmed in the same place. Like, so they had all the same things going for them. It's just one was probably noticeably hindered by their budget versus the other.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. You could tell there's that scene where John Murdoch is running, and as the buildings are changing,
Mm-hmm.
And some of those buildings, I swear, are the same that Trinity is running on in the beginning of The Matrix when she's running away from the agents. It's like the exact same look and feel, like exactly.
And not only that, there's on the street, there's like facades and things like that that I could have sworn were in The Matrix. So they were filmed in the exact same studio, probably back to back. So it's not surprising at all.
I would actually challenge your thoughts, though. I don't think a larger effects budget or better use, because even with The Matrix, even though they had a larger budget, they also had some wizards, you know, like they really did a lot with those dollars. They, you know, revolutionized effects for, you know, forever. People are still borrowing from what was established in that movie. But I think no matter how good things looked and how polished some of these effects were, I don't think that would do anything to settle those feelings of like, what the hell am I watching? Where is this coming from? It's all a big jumbled mess. I think, yes, there are some effect shots that are a bit, you know, not too great. Convincing. Yeah. And there are some things that feel almost like someone did a little stop motion, you know, claymation animation and stuff at times. You know, so there's all these little moments where that happens. But I think if those were all polished up and beautiful, maybe the movie might reach another level of like awe inspiring when you're watching it. But I don't think it would do much to make it that much more solid of a movie for all the reasons and things you said earlier.
And that's, I think that that's fair. But on the same token, I also remember going to movies in 1998, 1999 and thinking to myself in one, wow, like this is amazing, and I'm you know, completely entrenched in this, and then in the other one going, well, okay, I mean, you know, I'm having trouble getting into it because of, you know, I can tell what's fake and what's not. Like that's sort of what I'm talking about, is like having the ability to immerse your audience in this world. Like The Matrix does that really well, and this just kind of doesn't.
Yeah.
That's all that I mean from an effect standpoint. But the budget could be used for a number of different things, not the least of which is writing. Like, and not to say that there's, you know, anything wrong with the job that Alex Proyas and David Goyer and Lem Dobbs did with the writing, but they could have hired more staff to write. They could have developed more story. They could have added 30 minutes of runtime to this movie and had something, you know, spectacular.
Yeah. And all of this effort and all this work just to do, you know, a prequel for The Lost Boys was kind of puzzling to me, but that's what this is. And
that's it. That's what it was. It was a prequel to The Lost Boys.
Yeah. And a prequel to Flatliners. It's all the same universe.
Nice. Well done.
The Kieferverse.
The Kieferverse. Damn it, Chloe.
No, not they. Just like Marvel and Disney, they don't always combine TV shows and movie universes, though. So 24 is not a part of the universe.
Oh, no.
I thought it was. And again, this is not necessarily anything good, bad, or indifferent about the movie, but if we're going to keep referencing other movie franchises and things that we see, it was funny to have William Hurt and Jennifer Connelly in the movie, considering their relationship to each other in Marvel, like with, say, The Incredible Hulk.
Right.
And, you know, that whole, like, father-daughter dynamic from Marvel, and so that was threw me off a little bit. And it was just like seeing all these people and be like, oh, I know him from this TV series called
this was absolutely that movie, though.
Yeah,
like, oh, I know him from everyone. That and I know her from that. Like, there was one of the fucking vampire Morlocks was in a little known series based on the Sword of Truth book by Terry Goodkind. Legend of the Seeker, yes.
Yeah, he was
known by anyone but me and John Deck.
Jesus Christ. But like It's funny because when that came out, I thought it was an odd choice for Zed. Like, it's not how I pictured it in my head. But then there he was, and I spent most of the movie just being like, how do I know this guy? he's not Herman Munster. Like, why am I trying to connect this guy? And then one of the other strangers, alien Morlock fellows, you know, was from Rocky Horror. And, you know, was...
Oh, that's right.
And so, like there were just people, you know, that just, like, tickle your brain just enough to go, wait a second. And then, like, the head Morlock guy, Mr. Book, like, I'm, like, just, like, what do I know him from? I know he's kind of been a bit player in a bunch of different, you know, things. Just kind of some generic old guy, but like I know I've seen him probably in some British movie or something, I don't know, but it's like it just constantly did that again, neither here nor there.
Now I need to look him up, because I meant to look him up last night when I was watching this, and I want to know what I know him from. Not Dark City, come on. He was in all kinds of British TV. Jeez. I don't know, I can't find anything.
Yeah, as endlessly fascinating as it would be to track down every little thing that this guy's been in. No, I mean, I think, just to, again, to kind of summarize with the movie, I think that it makes sense to me why it never quite tipped the scales and became a super cult classic, although, depending upon your definition of things, it certainly gets brought up by people in that underrated category a lot. But I think between the way they put together the narrative, and it's all in pieces and all over the place, like you were saying, and the fact that it didn't stand out for being mind-blowing in its visual effects because of budgets and stuff like that, it just didn't have the repeat watchability. Like, there's so many things where it just didn't quite connect, and so I don't think it ever got there. But at the end of the day, from my perspective, I think it wasn't bad, and I feel like the overall experience was fun to piece it together and to really just think about, you know, like, it did make me think about a bunch of other movies, like I was saying before, like Inception, you know, and The Matrix, and all these things where elements are borrowed from this as you're trying to figure out the puzzle of existence and what's happening here. And you try to think, okay, so there's these alien jellyfish, and what, as we all know, alien jellyfish parasites that live in people's heads, corpses' heads, and animate their bodies. There's three things that they don't like. They don't like sunlight, they don't like water, and they don't like free will.
Food.
And they don't like
midnight.
Yeah, they don't like food after midnight, because then they turn into the mean monsters with the sharp teeth.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I feel like Gremlins really stole that from them in reverse.
Well, it's a time travel thing.
Yeah, it's a time travel thing. So yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I really didn't dislike this movie at all. It was a good watch, and I'd recommend it for people who like that throwback sci-fi kind of noir steampunk, what's going on here, like just a little touch of Blade Runner here, just a little touch of Poltergeist there, just a little touch of all these other little elements, a touch of The Crow, a touch of I don't know, insert what you want. It's not just one thing, it's a lot of things crammed together, and that's why it can be a little bit confusing, but I think it's worth it. See it at least once and take it in.
And I agree. I would say watch it to the end, like really give it a fair shot. It does come together eventually, and maybe it's not in the most satisfying way, but it does come together. It's a perfectly adequate movie. I enjoyed watching it, and now talking about it with John. Yeah, it was good. It was fine. I was good with it. River Cyril's good.
So do we continue down this path? You know, we've been teasing and talking about this idea of pursuing the Cybertronic punk-esque things, or at the very least, you know, movies that fall within this genre, or have we had our fill? That's the thing. I don't know if we can decide that the second, but it'll be interesting to circle back and say, did this whet our appetite for bigger and better, or do we want to just take a right turn and go do like Little House on the Prairie or something?
Well, I mean, why don't we talk about it after this, and we'll also we'll let the audience weigh in if you want to jump in on the socials or shoot us an email. John's going to tell you how to do that in a moment, but do that and let us know what you want us to do, if you want us to continue down this this dark cyberpunk dystopian hellscape, or should we pivot and go to something else? So let us know. But that's our show, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to us each and every week as we distill another favorite from our past. You can get new episodes every Monday, so come and hang out with us on Apple and Spotify and Stitcher and all those different podcast apps. You can also head over to tmdpod.com. That's where our website is and our episodes are, and our beautiful faces are there as well. So come and check us out and listen to John for this next part.
Yeah, listen to me now. The music in our podcast was not written by Clive Barker. Even though you thought maybe Clive Barker had a hand in writing Dark City, he didn't do that either. And he didn't write the music for Dark City. He didn't write a book about Dark City. It just has nothing to do with it. So quit talking about Clive Barker and start talking about Semaphore and their song Destroying the Evidence, which we use in our show. Also, email us, memorydistillery@gmail.com. That's where we want to hear from you, especially if you've got thoughts on this overall genre of specialized sci-fi that we're debating, going dark and deep and getting dirty. I don't know what I'm saying, but it really is disturbing, and it really is something that we want to know. Should we keep checking things out? Should we go back and test? Should we do Metropolis? You know, should we be doing Brazil? Should we be, you know, like where does the madness stop? Do we need to watch Equilibrium? Is that what's going to happen? I don't know. You can help weigh in on that and tell us what you think. Also, just hop on Facebook and look for the Memory Distillery. It's a good place also to post your favorite movies, things that you'd like us to review and dig into and build things out from there. Also, you know what? If you like Twitter still, that's cool. There's only like 20 million of you that like us on Twitter. And so if that's where you prefer to communicate, you know, hit us up at TMD Pod. But overall, we're just grateful that you hung around long enough for us to tell you how creepy everything is and how it's going to get much worse. And you should be invited along on that journey. So thanks for listening. I'm John Deck.
And I'm Anthony Veneri, and this has been the Memory Distillery.